Today we are talking to Jennifer Tennican. Jen is the producer, writer, and director of her film production company called Jen 10 Productions, and she specializes in documentaries. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks for having me, Emmy.
Tell us about your journey to Jackson. When did you make your home here in the Valley, and what brought you here?
My journey to Jackson, I think it began, technically it probably began in 2001 when I came out here for the first time, and it was to visit my husband's daughter who was living here part-time. And that was the first time I'd ever been in Jackson. My husband had been here previously. And, you know, I mean, like so many people who are taken with the beauty of the Valley, the next question was, after a few weeks of visiting, maybe we should get a place. So, and the other reason for that was to be close to family. And Mike's daughter, I can't remember if she had had Miles. I think she had Miles at that point. So we were going to be super present grandparents.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Florida in a small town called Indy Atlantic, which most people mishear and then go, you grew up in the Atlantic? Did you have an island? Were you wealthy?
Well, tell us about your growing up in Florida and share with us some of your growing up memories, something that stands out in your mind.
Let's see. Well, I grew up on the east coast of Florida, central. We were very, you know, about 30 miles south of Cocoa Beach and Cape Canaveral, where the space launches were.
Oh, right.
And so we grew up, you know, being let out of school to watch the launches. We'd go out on the fields, and that's a pretty profound memory of watching the launches. Mm-hmm. I played a lot of tennis growing up. My mother found tennis later in life, and she sort of introduced me to it as a kid. And I played competitive tennis in Florida for many years. And I was kind of not that well behaved. I was a little bit of a John McEnroe, kind of mad at yourself, mad at everybody. Not totally. Anyway, I play tennis now once a year, whether I need to or not. But that's about it.
Did you grow up competing though?
I did, and. I liked the practicing. I was not particularly a good competitor. I'm not sure whether I lacked the killer instinct or I don't know. I was just maladjusted. I'm not sure.
Maladjusted. Do you have brothers and sisters, Jen?
Yeah, speaking of maladjusted, I had a brother. Uh-huh. He passed away several years ago. Mm-hmm. We had a huge age difference between us. We have an extremely, I would say, unique family in terms of ages. My brother was 20 years older. There were no children in between. Same parents, sort of a, we would call it a reproductive hiatus, perhaps, where maybe you want to wait and find out how the first child turned out and then go, oh, yes, okay, let's do that again. So I was, and I was not an accident. And any of you who are thinking that now, shame on you, I was not. And my mother, you know, was a trendsetter way before the time that was popular, you know, everybody now 40, 45, having their first child. She was having her second child, but she was 42 at the time, and that was 1966. So she was a bit of a trendsetter.
And this was all planned.
She said it was. I don't know. There were thyroid issues. I really don't know. I mean, that's the other thing. When your family is so spread out age-wise, a lot of it happens before you're ever on the scene and is just kind of told to you as some kind of family lore. So, yes, I am completely confident that I was planned and wanted, and they tried for many years and then succeeded.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I think so.
I think so, too. Tell me about, I was reading your bio, and I believe you have a degree in English.
I do.
How did you go from a degree in English to establishing a film career?
When I went to college at Wellesley, there was no film program. And I think, you know, I graduated in 88, 89. That was before, I think, film programs really blossomed in a lot of colleges. So it really wasn't an avenue that was open to me, I think.
It wasn't an option.
No.
No.
Okay. So it was and plus, I mean, I had done a lot of things in the arts in college. I'd been involved in theater production. I'd, you know, been an actor and all of those things. The question was, you know, when you get out of school and when you have to make a living, the arts, it's a tough way to make a living, absolutely. I mean, and I was fearful, I think, of pursuing it sort of full bore. So I took some more practical things after, you know, I sort of had a more practical path after college. Even the English degree was great as a liberal arts degree. I got a lot of exposure to different things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, after that, I was a headhunter for an executive search firm that placed mostly PhD and, you know, master's level scientists in research and development labs. And this was in the Boston area. So it was sort of the boom of R&D and, you know, all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then after that cratered, I moved to commercial real estate. And I was a commercial real estate appraiser for many years in Boston. And then, so the shift to filmmaking was a later career shift.
I'll say.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not that late. Don't make it sound that late, for sakes.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant that, you know, going from working in commercial real estate to film production seems light years apart.
It is in some ways. I think sort of the research and development part of it, you know, developing the story and developing the context. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of I love research. If I could get locked in a library, it would not be the worst thing in the world.
So what inspired you to start a production career?
What inspired me?
What was the jumping off point?
It was preceded by 2 years that my husband and I spent in Spain. He had a consulting assignment there that was supposed to last 6 months, but kind of got renewed and went to 2 years. And before we went over, you know, basically the question was, do you mind quitting your job as a commercial real estate appraiser for this amazing opportunity to go live in Spain? And, you know, it was one of those, ooh, let me think. Yes, I'm fine quitting my job. And so Spain was interesting. I learned how to speak Spanish. I met a lot of people. I took a lot of different classes. You know, I was a bit jealous of him and his professional connection with his group that he had there. So it made me think about, you know, what I wanted to do when I came back. Did I want to go back into commercial real estate? What did I want to do? And the arts had always, I mean, I love film. I love documentary in particular. Mm-hmm. And so when I came back, I apprenticed with some documentary filmmakers in the Boston area who did a lot of work for WGBH in Boston and worked on a lot of Nova shows. It was called the Documentary Guild, and they are no longer in existence, but the two principals were Rob Whittlesey and Noel Buckner, and they're both fantastic filmmakers and great people, and a bit like an old married couple. They'd worked together for a lot of years, so and they did all their own, you know, they did everything from writing the script to the filming to the audio.
They were your inspiration.
They were my mentors, yes, and I worked for them for several years.
And then when did you break out on your own to start your own production company?
I'm trying to figure out if I think I really did it seriously when I got here. I'd done a bit of it when I was back, and this was all in the Boston area when we came back from Spain. Yeah, I think that I really started to establish myself here. There's a great group of local, you know, filmmakers here, very talented, very willing to, you know, share their knowledge and expertise. And it's a tight community. And I think it's a very, and everybody has their own, you know, little niche in what they do. I mean, it's good. I think there's enough to go around.
Tell us about some of the films that you've produced.
Wow, this is not going to take that long.
Sorry. It's not going to take that long.
So
interview's over.
Right, it's over. Goodbye. When I was working for the Documentary Guild in Boston, I was simultaneously working on a documentary about a Boston area climber who took 7 years to put a route up on Cannon Cliff up in Franconia Notch in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And this was aimed at sort of the Banff-type film festivals, the mountain film festivals. I myself am a rock climber. This happened to be someone I knew who exhibited this kind of passion and sort of the balance of having a real full-blown life and being sort of middle-aged and trying to maintain his passion and trying to push this thing forward. It was just this Sisyphean feat he was trying to do, which was finish this thing, and he kept losing partners, and his body kept breaking down. And anyway, it seemed like a great story. So I was working on that sort of simultaneously to interning and being a production assistant. Benedictus was the first film that I produced as Gen 10 production.
And what does Benedictus mean?
Benedictus is the name of the root on canon. You'd have to look at Benedictus, I'm sure, is something like prayer or whatever. Check your Latin. Check your Latin. I don't remember.
And you entered that film in the Banff Film Festival?
We sent a one-hour version to Banff, and Banff is extremely competitive, and I think particularly at the one-hour mark where you get things like National Geographic and the BBC. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew, and I was working, I was co-producing it with someone else, and I think we had slightly different ideas about what might work best. Anyway, we did not get in, and I, for that reason, I'm not fond of Banff, but maybe they could get back into my good graces at some point. No, I'm just kidding. But no, we did not get accepted. But it got we ended up cutting a shorter version of it. That got accepted into the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival. Okay. And we showed it at the Alpinist Film Festival several years back when it was, I think it was at the Center for the Arts. I think we've had good success with that. I've yet to produce it on DVD, which is on my to-do list. But I think it's – a lot of people said it was great and enjoyed it. So I'm not going to listen to anyone who didn't say it was
awesome.
Can
they go – do you have a website where people can go and look at some of the work you've done?
Yeah. They can go to gen10productions.com, J-E-N-T-E-N, productions.com. And there's a page that has work samples. And I think there's a trailer for Benedictus there.
How about the current – I read about – the film that you're doing on the Stagecoach. What's the title of that?
It's creatively titled, no. It's The Stagecoach Bar, An American Crossroads.
And then there's one that I read about that has to do with the Stagecoach, but it's about Bob Dylan.
Yeah, this was the one that we entered into the Wyoming Short Film Contest.
Okay.
By we, I mean me. No.
Me, myself, and I.
No. Other people helped me. In fact, David Swift was very helpful on it. I mean, I'm very big into collaborative efforts with people. That was our entry into the 2011 Wyoming Short Film Contest. And it was sort of a spinoff of the Coach film. It was this funny thing that actually kept coming up is, you know, you'd be talking to a humanities scholar or you'd be talking to an old timer or somebody and you were trying to get some pithy information about, you know, what was the social structure like back then? Or, you know, what was the conflict between the hippies and the cowboys? You were trying to get to something meaningful. And the whole time they were going, you know, I heard Bob Dylan played out there. What about the time Bob Dylan played out there? And it just, I mean, it constantly derailed all these,
all these
discussions trying to get to something pithy. And so I decided I had no time. It was ridiculous to do it, actually. But it worked out. It worked out well because we won the Wyoming Short Film Contest, gave us $25,000 towards our next production.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And that's a big help. So that money basically has come to me, and then I have then donated it to the Jackson Hole Historical Society, earmarked for this project. So that's the way
that
went.
Okay.
But it was just supposed to be this humorous little spoof about my quest to find out the truth about this urban myth. It's funny. I mean, it's funny how many times still people come up and say, Bob Dylan played there. Do you remember? You know, were you there? And then I had somebody say, what did he say? It was like, yeah, and Tom Petty was there too. Or I don't know. It just keeps getting better and better. George Harrison or I.
It's a Fish story.
Meaning Fish played there? Fish did play there.
No,
yeah.
No.
But
I mean, it keeps getting bigger.
Yes. It's, and you don't want to break people's hearts. And the point is, in the end, if the story is great, just go with the story, probably.
And so how is the other one coming along, the one that's about the Stagecoach?
The one-hour film that we're doing that is sort of using the Stagecoach as this lens to look at cultural change and historical evolution is going well. We are in post-production right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very, you know, a modest budget for this for a one-hour high-definition film. We have raised 80% of the funds. All the funds have been raised either through grants or donations, private donations, family foundation donations. Mm-hmm. So we still have 20% to raise. We would very much like to do that by now. No,
by now.
we hope to have it. We hope to have a finished film by the end of January, early February. So the sooner the better. And we really do need the funds to get the rest of it done. But we've had good luck with grants from. Mm-hmm. The Wyoming Cultural Trust Fund awarded us a grant, Wyoming Humanities Council, Wyoming Arts Council, Wyoming Society for Historic Records. We've gotten a lot of different help from organizations, but also, I mean, I think we have something like 170 individual donors at this point. And the project, it is under the auspices of the Historical Society as a program of theirs. So all donations are tax deductible, and that's been a big help in mm-hmm. motivating people, mm-hmm. I think, to support this. And the fact that everything that we collect for the film, whether it gets in the film or not, will end up archived with the Historical Society. And this will augment their collection, mm-hmm. I think, in decades that they don't have that much material at this point. I mean, the 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, history is yesterday, in effect. You know, I mean, it's right. not just the homesteaders and the pioneers that we need to cover. Mm-hmm. And this project, I think, it's highly leveraged. We're killing many birds with one stone.
Now, what was your idea to come up with this, to focus on the Stagecoach as being the lens to look at change in Jackson? How did you come up with the whole concept and teaming up with and collaborating with the Historical Society?
The initial idea came from an interview, well, not an interview, a short film. Again, the Wyoming Short Film Contest has sort of been a motivator for a lot of this. So in 2009, I did a short film featuring Bill Briggs. And that was really mm-hmm. my first experience with the coach, because if you're gonna do a film on Bill Briggs, you film him, if you film him playing music, it's the Hoot and the Coach. And so that was my first exposure, a Sunday night at the Coach. I'm not the kind of person, I'd never really been in the bar. I haven't spent a lot of time in bars. I probably have some kind of distrust of bars. It's funny, anybody who knows me and who knows I'm doing this film thinks it's hilarious that I'm the person who's doing a film about a bar. Because I'm a pathetic, I'm a teetotaler, I'm a pathetic drinker, and, I'm married, I'm not going there to flirt, and I don't know. But I love the dance, I love the music, and, that's a lot of the Sunday night scene, and there's a lot more to the bar than just the Sunday night scene, and there's a lot more to the story of how mm-hmm. culture and communities have been fostered over time. It's hard to deny the significance of a 42-year tradition.
Is the Sunday night at the Coach a 42-year tradition?
Absolutely. It started in 1969. It's had its own little evolution from, guys who just kind of walked around and played and for the most part were, just kind of amateur musicians. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the talent. Talent has always been there. What they have now is very different. And Bill has been the contiguous link through the – Bill Briggs has been the contiguous link through, all the iterations of the band.
So who's your voice in the documentary? Is it lots of voices, or do you have a main voice telling a story?
We didn't go with a narrator sort of voice of God thing with it, or we haven't. I mean, who knows? But, uh-huh. I think we're pretty comfortable with we've divided it into four acts, essentially, each mm-hmm. being 20-year periods. So Act 1 is the 40s and the 50s, then the 60s and the 70s, 80s, 90s, and then 2000 to present. And for each of those acts, there are certain characters that are the main characters.
Oh, okay.
And so it's basically their voices and their stories. And, it's not so much... For anyone who comes thinking it's simply going to be, sort of a recitation of facts about the bar and, stories about sort of crazy drunken exploits. I mean, to me, you could do it that way. Mm-hmm. You could absolutely do it that way. Right. But it doesn't hold that much interest to me. And I don't think that the Historical Society would have been that excited to get involved and bully for them.
Yeah.
Because I think mm-hmm. what we're trying to do with the characters is tell these more complex stories about these bigger issues like how do outsiders become insiders? How in an increasingly, interconnected world with all of these electronic connections, do you maintain sort of a personal relationship? How do you stay connected in your community?
Right.
Don't we all need a place where we can just go and feel comfortable? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. and sort of and have a live sort of interactive experience? Sometimes, don't you just feel sometimes you just want to slap those iPhones out of people's hands? Come on, you do. You do. Drop it.
Especially
drop it.
My 14-year-old.
It's like dogs, right?
Yeah.
Back away from the iPhone. Listen to the music. Have a conversation. That kind of thing. I mean, it's, you know, it's beautiful. And the other thing that I think happens there that I'm not all that familiar with is a multi-generational group that gets together. So you might have some ski bum kids who are spending some, you know, winters here in their 20s, you know, or whatever, working at the village, interacting with 70-year-olds or 50-year-olds or, you know, retired CEOs or, you know, ranchers or, you know, I mean, it's sort of the beauty of that cultural and social intermingling that doesn't, I don't think that happens at that many places. And I think the coach is, you know, while there are a lot of bars with history in this town, and I, you know, I'm sure you could do a documentary on every one.
Right.
The thing that separates the coach for me is that because it's not in Jackson, because it's sort of not on the direct tourist path, that it's always had sort of a slightly tighter community feel.
A local feel.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure there are people who disagree with me and they should feel free to do that. I feel if you do something in this town and you don't piss somebody off, you probably haven't done a very good job.
Oh,
don't you think? I mean, everybody's opinionated,
maybe,
right?
Maybe I'm doing a really good job then.
You piss a lot of people.
I hope not. I think all of that is so interesting. The other thing I wanted to ask you about producing this film is the people that you used, that you're interviewing, and they're telling a story. They're kind of maybe reliving their history in Jackson and how it's grown and changed. And are they all still alive? I mean, are these all... Are you having to use some actors to fill in, or...?
We haven't quite made a final... They're just a couple of ones that we would maybe consider someone doing a voiceover with, but we're not exactly sure about that at this point. Mm-hmm. We're lucky. Most of them, you know, the people who are telling the stories about the 40s and the 50s are still alive and still very with it. And we actually ended up interviewing Billy and Martha Saunders. Billy grew up here in Jackson and then went away, served in World War II, came back, rodeoed out on the side of Walt's Bar, you know, the rodeo that was there for 20 years. Billy eventually ended up being the ranch manager at Fish Creek Ranch, Gil Ordway's ranch. And now they live down in Bondurant. So they're in their mid-80s. Mm-hmm. And we interviewed both Billy and Martha, his wife.
I bet that's been fun for you.
Yeah, it would be nice to, you know, if Walt Callahan, who's, you know, everybody associates Walt, he's the first owner of the bar, the Stagecoach as we know it. And it would be great if we had him, but we missed him by several years. You know, he was a lot of these people like Billy and Martha can talk about, you know, I mean, they knew him, Pam McCool, lots of kids who came here, you know, Pam McCool came here in the probably 40s and 50s as a kid from the East, you know, I mean, there's sort of lots of different perspectives, which is part of what we're trying to get across in this, is that it's always been a bit of a melting pot.
Well, before you leave us, I want to ask you where you see yourself in the future with your film production company.
I see myself continuing to pursue independent documentaries. Mm-hmm. I see myself better compensated after having proved that I can do this to
That's
as many people as necessary.
For.
Yes. No, I'm all about paying your dues. And, you know, I see myself continuing to live here in the Valley and hopefully, you know, contributing in some way. I think that's one of the important things about this project to me is that it feels like it's giving something back. And by doing this, that it is encouraging an interest in telling our own stories and preserving our own history. So that's a really great thing to do.
I think that's wonderful. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have been here.